Welcome home. We are WNST, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We are Baltimore positive. We're trying to get through this baseball trading deadline. I'm trying to find other things to talk about, but everyone is talking baseball around here. And I thought of an old friend. I haven't had him on in a couple of years, certainly not during the Zoom era. But Leo Mazzonio and I go way back to me trying to figure out Braves pitching before everybody went to the Hall of Fame 30 years ago. I used to see Leo out on the road, and Leo is a Marylander, even though he claims South Carolina and Georgia as his homeland. But and with the All-Star game in Atlanta, and the Battery and all of that, I had reached to Leo before the All-Star break and said, "Hey, you want to come on?" He's like, "Yeah, I'm going to the All-Star break next week in Atlanta." I'm like, "Let's get you on afterwards." So, Leo, welcome. I guess you consider Baltimore sort of home, maybe a little bit outside of Cumberland, right?
Right, yeah, I absolutely I do. That's where I grew up and had a great time growing up and close to Cumberland, Maryland, and that's where I learned all my baseball as a youngster, and it played a big part in my signing with the Giants out of high school and starting my professional career, which lasted 42 years.
Leo, I gotta tell you, man, I'm sponsored by the Maryland Lottery, and we do these crab cake tours, and I'm off the road for a couple weeks here, and we're doing our 27th anniversary next month. They had a huge lottery winner in a town called Lonoconing, which
I
is
know,
out.
yeah.
So they had a big winner, and I talk about that with John because it was the biggest winner in state history. Literally accidentally, not on purpose, but I've explored the state because of crab cakes, and I did a little fly fishing out in that part of the world, a place
Right.
called Luke and Williamsport, way out there on the water with Dan Rogers a couple years ago. And I drove through Lonoconing, and as I drove through, my wife was actually driving, and I'm looking around at the big cliff, and I'm looking down. And there's Lefty Grove Park. I'm like, wait, turn the car
Absolutely.
around. Turn the
That's the home
car
of
around.
Lefty Grove.
Yeah,
That's the home. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You go in, if you're coming in, there's a sign and it says home of Lefty Grove.
there's a
You can go
beautiful
in.
little park, and it's almost like a wiffle ball park for like kids. And it
Yeah.
just sits there on this in this former coal mining community at the edge. What a
Coal mine.
beautiful part of the world you grew up in. I don't think I've ever told you that because I didn't know that the last time I saw you, because I've been driving out there to Deep Creek and
Oh,
Swallow
Deep Creek's
Falls and
beautiful.
just all of that part of the state. And you're like, it's a baseball cradle. I'm like, I drove past Lefty Grove Park 20 minutes from your house, and I'm like, yeah, I guess. How did baseball find you out there? Is I mean, Orioles, obviously, maybe Pirates a little bit.
That's San Francisco of all teams. And what I was doing, I was pitching in the Penmar League, and we had a first baseman that signed with the Giants, Junie Perry. And I said, Junie, and I was like 16 playing with men. That's how I really learned how to play the game. And he signed with the Giants, and he became a bird dog, as they called him then. And I said, as great a player as you are, how come you didn't make it? He said, well, he said, I had two guys in front of me, Willie McCovey and Orlando Cepeda. I said, well, I get it then, but, and he got Chick Genovese in, the scout from the Giants, to watch me pitch. And I signed a couple of days later. So that's how that all started. But, if when you getting back to Lonoconee, it's Lefty Grove, you go into Cumberland, it was Sam Perlazzo and Bob Robertson. And then you go into Westernport, and it says the home of Leo Mazzoni. So, that's a pretty good group to have out of that real small area.
Now, you had some flooding out there in your homeland a couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah. Oh man, it was a mess. Floods, everything else.
You know, I actually fished in Westernport. It's crazy that you're from there. I parked my car at the McDonald's right there and walked up the way and waded into the water and put my ass on a rock and had waders on and was just, I was trying to be like Lefty Cray. I mean, I was trying to figure it all out. As a kid, I mean, you had that Tom Sawyer thing going on out there, man.
Right. Well, it was a wonderful place when I was a kid. The paper mills were going strong, the coal mines. It's not that anymore. It's gone. It's you could drive your car on the sidewalk and not hit anybody because there's nobody around. And all the people that the parents that I grew up with, and they was in charge of the league, of course, they're all gone. They're all the guys came back from World War II, and they helped expand the little leagues so that more kids could play. And that's how it all started, but it's all gone. And all the industry, the Westvaco Paper Company, which my dad worked at for 42 years, that finally shut down. That put the end of all of Luke, Piedmont, and Westernport.
Yeah, Dan Rogic explained all that history to me as I was out there, and how, the mills had sort of polluted some of the water, and the fish had
Yes.
changed, and rainbow trout, which we grabbed out of the water. Leo Mazzoni's here. He's here to talk pitching, but I wanted to talk a little Maryland, just because a lot of people don't know that about you. They remember your 5 minutes here in Baltimore and your time here as a pitching coach and the legend of you. But the baseball part of you, do you marvel when you go to an All-Star game, even all these years later, that you were pretty good, you could pitch a little bit? But then seeing what a Maddux and a Glavine and like the guys that you worked with
Right.
and the Chipper Joneses, the greatest of great players, even guys that did it pretty good, play minor league ball, whatever, maybe got a cup of coffee. But
Right.
to see that sort of excellence over your lifetime, still marvel at that.
Oh, absolutely, I do. I mean, when I was down there this week, I'm sitting at a table with a pitcher named Raleigh Fingers, and Raleigh Fingers and I are signing autographs, and I'm looking over at him going, I don't know if I fit in with right, should be next to him, maybe. Or when we were in Cooperstown, I've signed autographs in Cooperstown because it was Braves related. And heck, I was with Johnny Bench and Ernie Banks and Lasorda and Whitey Ford, and I'm just sitting there understanding that all my childhood dreams came true. Then I
Just in
saw
a
Eddie
different
Murray.
way, in a different
Yeah,
way, right?
I saw Eddie Murray, and I said, "Hey, Eddie, how you doing?" He told me to go blank myself, and I said, "What, are you still upset about the 95 World Series?" He goes, "Yeah." He said, "Leo," he said, "I told our hitters, Braves pitchers are going to go down and away for strike one. Then you're never going to see another strike, so don't swing." He said, and we swung.
Well, I was at all of those games in 1995, and with the memories coming back when you go to Atlanta at this point in your life, make a little money, sign some autographs, make people smile, take pictures, whatever, see people. Give me a vibe of that, because let's be honest. In 95, launching pad, Circle Stadium, Fulton County. Then that Muhammad Ali, and then you move into sort of a weird kind of a stadium for a minute, and they sort of fixed it up a little bit. Then they move it out. The vibe of Atlanta baseball during your—I mean, it's changed three different times now, and yet that All-Star game kind of goes off without a hitch, and it feels like the Braves are still the kings of the South as far as a baseball thing, and what they've managed to do financially there is sort of the envy of what we would love to do in downtown Baltimore, which we sort of maybe missed out on in the early 90s with Camden Yards.
Well, the evolution of the launching pad when they said we could never have pitching there, we dispelled that. And then moving into Turner Field, we thought it was a beautiful stadium, beautiful ballpark, and we had a great time there too. But at Truist Park, the surrounding area now at Truist Park, it's like a city. They have their own city. All the restaurants, all the bars, all everything, apartments, hotels. You could actually go there and enjoy that a ball game without going inside the stadium. That's how nice it is. And it's called the Battery. So, matter of fact, Monday night I'm going down to speak to a group at the Omni Hotel on behalf of the Atlanta Braves, and then on Friday I go down again back to Atlanta to speak to a group for at a luncheon for the Atlanta Braves. So, and then I was put in this past year. I was put in the State of Georgia Hall of Fame. And I'm in the Atlanta Braves Hall of Fame, and I'm in the City of Atlanta Hall of Fame. So the state of Georgia has been real good to me.
Well, but when you go down there, it's a different experience. What I'm saying is, like Memorial Stadium for me as a kid, it ain't there anymore. It's a Y. Thank God for that. And they're playing ball down there, and they're doing things in that space. But it is a different experience to go back. Like it's the next thing for them, and the Braves have made that move as a franchise very, very deftly, to keep all of your legends alive, really.
Oh, absolutely. You're speaking of Baltimore. When I grew up, I loved the Baltimore Colts. And my hero was Johnny Unitas. Matter of fact, I saw Johnny Unitas at a spring training game in West Palm Beach, and I looked up in the stands and I went, "Man, is that Johnny Unitas?" And it was. In between innings, I took a ball and asked him to sign a baseball for me. And he goes, "I'd love to." And I so my one of my favorite balls is Johnny Unitas on a baseball, and when they moved out of Baltimore in '84, I tell you what, I was sick to my stomach. Sick to my stomach. I could have shot anybody that was moving them out, or at least give the trucks a flat tire, because our family just loved the Baltimore Colts.
Well, I mean, and for going to the All-Star game this week, How do you feel about derbies and the competition and the swing off at the end? I mean, I was in Milwaukee when Bud Selig did this. I don't know if you were there. You might have been there too that day. But the All-Star game, Ray Fosse and Pete Rose, my dad always hated, Pete Rose because of that, and just said it's an exhibition, it's a game. I tell you, I attended 20 of them. I think you were a part of them. I think I talked to you on the field before or after games in that
Right.
era. The competitive nature of it, what it is, what it's supposed to be. You're in the heart of it right now. Are they getting it right, Major League Baseball, the All-Star game?
Yeah, it's right. But let me tell you something. When you're in that dugout for All-Star games, it's competitive. I mean, the first thing they say, used to have your meeting with the National League Commissioner, the American League Commissioner. I mean, they're presidents of each league. And they say, hey, look, we got to win this game, da 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 da, And so, I remember Barry Bonds coming up to me one time. He said, Leo, he said, I got a decision to make. I said, what's that, Barry? He goes, well, if we have a runner on second base, he said, should I drive in the first one for the National League or try to hit a home run? And I said, well, first time up, try to get us to lead, and then second time up, go ahead and hit a home run. He drove in the first run from second base on a single to right center and was on first base looking at me. And then there was, things like that that went on in the All-Star game, All-Star games. I was there when Randy Johnson almost threw that ball over Kruk's head. And
That was here in Baltimore,
yeah,
Leo.
it was in Baltimore. And
Yeah.
once Losada was coaching third, somebody flew, hit it, almost hit him with a bat. The bat jumped out of the hitter's hands and almost took him out. So, but yeah, listen, in baseball, I had a hard time with, a starting pitcher for the American League being mic'd, and then talking to the fans while he's trying to pitch, and I thought, well, this, and that's the first time he gave up three runs in one inning in his career. But all the jibber jabbing instead of playing the game, I personally loved watching the game. I just turned the volume down. I just didn't want to listen to all the chatter and what the players were saying and this and that. Home Run Derby to me is, I didn't go to it. I mean, I remember we had Home Run Derby in 2000 in Turner Field. And once the Home Run Derby started, the coaching staff left because it just goes on and on and on. You're swinging for the fences, and it's nice for the fans, but it doesn't do anything for me. The swing off, I didn't even know that that was going to happen, to be honest with you.
I didn't either.
I mean, and I went, Bobby Cox told me the hardest games that he's ever had to manage is the All-Star game, because you want to do right by the players, you want to try to win the game, and you want to try to get everybody in as many guys as you can. So I think the swing off takes the pressure off everybody as far as running out of players. So I thought it went over extremely well, the swing off for extra innings. I personally don't think it's an exhibition game. I think it's for real. And but yeah, to see all. You know what? But as time goes by, you think more of the previous All-Star games than you do the one that's going on right now. Memories of tremendous games and tremendous All-Star games. Watching Jim Palmer or watching Whitey Ford or I know to this day that Whitey Ford could not get Willie Mays out in an All-Star game. Used to drive me nuts. But over the years, being a part of those All-Star games was absolutely awesome. I think the evolution of sport now, that's the way it is, and that's what you're going to see. You're going to see more entertainment and a lot of more going on than just actually playing an All-Star game. And I think it's also lost, the mystery's gone. I'm sure you understand the mystery of the American League against the National League, American League umpires and National League umpires. And with interplay, that's interleague play, that's all gone.
And the only way I could see Jim Palmer face Mike Schmidt or Pete Rose was to do an All-Star game or make it to the World Series. So Leo Mazzoni is here. We're geezing like old guys from last century. He is the legendary pitching coach, a Marylander. I always point that out, and always an Atlanta Brave. And all right, so you spent your time here in Baltimore a long time ago, and we talked about it. Angelos has since left us since you and I got together, and there's a new owner here who's already made his own bobblehead, which, that kind of speaks for itself. Team's in last place. Attendance is down. Lots and lots lots of my manager got fired. General manager fired the manager on a Saturday morning, Leo, and hid from the media for 3.5 days and reemerged in Milwaukee on Tuesday night. I mean, as a media member, as someone that you always had accountability, Bobby Cox, John Schuerholz, another great Baltimorean, not just a Marylander or Towson guy. There was always accountability in that era, whether in Baltimore was Sid Thrift or whether it was, Davey Johnson, whoever it was, answering questions and how the game is played. I mean, from what I understand, because they threw me out of the media a long time ago, Leo, from what I understand, the managers don't even make the lineups, right? So, like, the lineup's a consortium. It's stat-based. It's analytics. Stuff that I certainly don't recognize in that way. But when the output happens that all of your pitchers are getting hurt, they've shut Grayson Rodriguez down again this weekend, that they're doing something wrong, Leo, and I don't know what it is, and I'm not calling you to scream about it, but they're in last place again, and it sucks because the
No,
last 2 years it's been fun around here.
oh, absolutely. I think the way baseball handles pitching staffs in general now is absolutely brutal. For example, can you imagine making a starting rotation making 531 starts in a row from 91 to 93 and missing one start? Okay. Can you imagine with Bobby Cox and me together for almost 15 years that our starting rotations made 140 of averaged 140 to 162 game scheduled starts? So people don't want to listen to how we did it. And I try to explain it to everybody that we didn't care how hard somebody threw. What we cared about was touch on the ball, changing speeds, fastball command. But we did it by doing it off of a mound at 60 feet, 6 inches, going downhill to a catcher and doing it twice in between starts. So that way, if you try to throw as hard as you can in between starts, which I understand a lot of guys do now, you're nuts. You're crazy. In between is to try to build up for your next start. And the bottom line is that you can do it more often and practice your pitches on the mound and get some touch on the ball. If you're on the mound, everybody says, well, we throw flat-footed throwing. You know what flat-footed throwing does? Nothing. Flat-footed throwing, you play catch in the outfield before you go up on the in the bullpen to throw. I had a pitching coach tell me, well, when they get on the mound to throw in their practice sessions, he said they have a tendency to throw too hard. And I said, well, that's what the hell they pay you for, is to regulate the effort. And when I got the job in 90, not June of 90, Bobby had big meetings in Atlanta at the stadium, and I'd had a reputation of wherever I was in the minor leagues, our pitching staffs didn't break down. So then when Bobby wanted to figure out who was going to start running get in charge of the pitching in the farm system, I stood up and told my what I want to do, which I had been doing anyway, because Hank Aaron was my boss. He said, you take care of the pitchers, that's why I hired you. And so I had no directive from anybody on how to do it. I didn't want any directive from anybody on how to do it. So anyway, what put the icing on the cake was Hank Aaron stood up and said, all I can tell you, Bobby, is that wherever Leo goes, his pitching staffs don't break down. And one pitching coach said, well, he has him throwing a lot. He said, they'll have a tendency. And he said, I don't think they'll have anything left in August. I said, well, what do you do? And he goes, well, on the day that you have him on the mound, or that extra day that you have him on the mound, we play catch in the outfield. And I went, well, what? Tell me the difference. He goes, well, the difference is they go to the bullpen, they're going to have a tendency to throw too hard. And that's what I told him. That's what the hell they pay you for, is to regulate the effort. So we did that constantly. We constantly worked on being sneaky quick as opposed to overpowering. Because if sneaky, if you turn, if here's what pitchers resort to. Adversity in the game, they resort to superpower and super control. When you resort to superpower, you start going all over the place. You raise the risk of damaging your arm. Super control means you're trying to paint, and that means you're behind in the count. So you add all those up, and I try to bring that to a pitcher's attention so that when you do go out to the mound, when you're talking to the pitcher out on the mound, you always ask them, what's your most important pitch? And they'll say, well, fastball. Da-da-da. Your most important pitch is your next one. And that's what we used to try to talk about all the time. You can't call timeout and bring, if you walked a guy or whatever and you're ticked off at yourself, So, and I'm not going to go out there and say, look, you got to throw strikes. He's going to look at you and go, no kidding. And so I say, don't give in to the strike zone, and let's concentrate on the next most important pitch being your next pitch. Then we'll have damage control in the inning. Won't be any crooked numbers up there. We can give up one four times in a game, and we're going to win that game. We're right there. But anyway, things like that. The approach being that learning what your pitches do, and where the fault comes in the big leagues now is in the minor leagues. They are the greatest teacher a pitcher has is innings pitched, and they're taking that away from all those kids in the minor leagues. They're starting rotations to me in the big leagues now. Let me ask you a question. I get very passionate about this. I'm watching the Yankees and the Braves last night, right? Now, you had 3 or 4 days off for the All-Star break, right? And the Yankees had a bullpen day. How in the hell can you have a bullpen day when you've had 3 or 4 days off for the All-Star break and then you don't have a regular starter to start? How's that happen?
Well,
Okay.
something tells them in their analytics
Something in
that this is
me,
the way they want to set it up or something like that, right?
And I never heard of we're going to have a bullpen day till I retired. To me, that's an absolute joke.
I never
Somebody
heard of
got it.
load management in the NHL or the NBA either, Leo. I can't, I don't. My dad worked at the steel mill and never took a scratch, as he called it, which
Right.
I didn't realize that was a horse racing term. I mean, it is. My dad wasn't a horse racing guy. My dad would always say, "I never scratch," and then I'm like,
Yeah.
"Oh, it's like a horse scratching." My dad never scratched. I don't know. I mean, I covered Cal Ripken here for 15
Yeah.
years, so yeah, I'm with you.
And, I mean, you can't coach scared, and you got to let them get on the mound to learn how to pitch. Also, I do not believe you should develop a reliever in the minor leagues. In the minor leagues, like the great relievers that we had, I mean, Kent Merker, he was started in the minor leagues. Steve Bedrosian, guys like that, they started in the minor leagues, and then once they
Eckersley.
got to Triple A, halfway through Triple A, you would say, ask the Triple A manager and pitching coach. Not the front office people, the manager and pitching coach of the AAA team. Who do you think could be a possible closer and check out his rebound? So we would do that for a little while with the guy we thought. And then if he worked, you'd bring him up. But, I'm not checking with an analytical guy to see how a guy should pitch or how or this or that. If you have to do that, then all you're being as a coach is a yes man. That's all they are is yes men. And when I had two great bosses, Hank Aaron and Bobby Cox, and the two things they told me the exact same thing. Hank says, "There's your pitchers, you take care of them." Bobby Cox, when I got there, he goes, "Leo, there's your pitchers. Get to know every single one of them, spend all your time with them, and you take care of them." And so I had the thank God I had the leeway. Nobody was going to come downstairs from the front office and say, "Well, he's throwing a lot of innings, da 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 da." I had one time in Baltimore where Eric Bedard, he had 2 great years while we were there. And, the front office guy came down and said, "Leo," he said, "Bedard's going to pitch over 50 innings more than he did the previous year." I said, "Wasn't that great? That means he's pitching good." "Well, you got to be careful." I said, "Look, wh whoever came up with that number is full of you know what."
Never met Nolan Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, come on, Maddux, Glavis, I mean, all our guys,
Or
though.
Palmer. I mean, you can't talk to
Yeah, I
Palmer
mean,
without him
and you know
saying
what?
how broken all of this is, too. Yeah.
I know. And you know what Maddux used to tell me? He says, "Leo," he says, "you're only 100% before your first start." I said, "Then that's the rest of the year, you're not 100%, but that means you can't pitch." And the other thing is that anything that happens with a pitcher now is they're shut down. I mean, they're just. Everybody, look, or how about this one? Oh, well, he's getting a lot of innings. We're going to skip him a couple starts. Give him a breather. Go down to the wire in the pennant race. Well, that's the worst thing you can do. Pitchers get on a routine, and the way our pitchers stayed healthy is whatever we did in spring training, we were doing in October, getting ready for a World Series game or the playoffs. Nothing changed in between.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because I don't want to be interrupted, but you said in that
No, it's
first
okay.
meeting, you stood up to Hank Aaron and said, "This is the way I've done it. My pitchers don't get hurt." From that minute till the end of your career to now, How much has your philosophy changed? I mean, as regard to debt, what did you learn along the way just to maybe tweak things a little bit? Because it sounds like your philosophy about mound versus ground never changed. You still believe that 50 years later, A, because, and you're allowed to believe whatever you want because your shit worked. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I can't even argue with you, but I'm
Never threw a
wondering
damn
along the
leaf.
way, did you have any philosophical, even little bit of change because something Tom House was doing or something somebody else was doing, you know?
What I was doing was this. We were learning how to somebody if you threw an inside change up, right? Oh, you can't throw an inside change up. Well, over the evolu over my career with the guys, we found out that you could. You know, for example, Glavine threw an inside changeup to Jeff Bagwell by mistake. Bagwell almost fell down trying to hit it. So Glavine come in and sits down to me next to the dugout, and he goes, "Leo," he said, "you see that?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Maybe I should start throwing some inside changeups." I said, "Go ahead. You think it'll work?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Go ahead." Well, Maddox come around the corner and he said, "Tommy, go ahead." He said, "If they hit it, all they can do is hit, pull it foul." Okay. So now the next inning, he's throwing inside changeups, and Bobby Cox comes to me and says, "Leo, was that a changeup?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, was Javi Lopez sitting up inside?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Isn't that kind of dangerous?" I said, "Glavine said they can't hit that pitch." He goes, "Okay." You know, but that and you know stuff like that, and but different approaches. Maddox
That's
throwing
interesting that when
changeup.
Bobby would question you, or when Greg Maddux or Glavine are questioning you, or Smoltz. I mean, I guess you're listening to it. They were smart guys, right? You probably had some philosophical differences along the way, for
Absolutely.
sure, right?
Or if I had to, I used the tools that were available to me. For example, Smoltz had a hard time throwing his changeup, so I was going to teach him a split. This was after he was already good, but he had more trouble with left-hand hitters. So what I do, Bruce Sutter lived in Atlanta. So I called Bruce and told me to meet him for lunch, and I said, "Give me everything you know about the split because I'm going getting ready to teach it to Smoltz." And Smoltz picked it up and it became a huge weapon for him. But I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to talk to Don Sutton, who was doing the. Sutton says, "You want me to come down and look at some pitchers in the bullpen?" I said, "Absolutely." And he goes, "Me?" I said, "You won 320 some games. You were never on the disabled list for your entire career. Why would I not take? You'd have thought I gave, you know, he won the lottery." Jim Palmer, "Jim, what do you see? Can you know, give me some ideas on this guy or this guy or this guy, you know?" You got to take advantage of those tools, and nobody does that anymore. Well, all they do is they look at numbers and they look at percentages and do all that sort of thing. So, you know, as I evolved, the approach with our pitchers did not change. For example, when the big three were going, we still won. You know, you had Russ Ortiz, you had Mike Hampton, you had John Thompson, you had Jarrett Wright, John Burke. I mean, you had these guys that they kept on winning. You know, and when and a couple of them they were told were done. They get on the programs that we had, and they got big. Jarrett got a big contract with the Yankees after he was with us, and Burke got one with the Red Sox after both of them said they were washed up. So that's because we simplified the game. We looked at the pitchers and went, "We got two pitches going, we're going to win. We got three pitches going, we're going to throw a shutout. We get narrowed down to one, we're going to lose." And I ain't buying what I see on TV where this guy throws six or seven pitches. And I ain't buying it. "Oh, he's throwing a sweeper. Give me a break." You know, it's an off-speed curveball for crying out loud. You know, and the terminology that they're using, that's why I have to turn the volume down and actually watch the game.
Leo Mazzoni is here, and look, I can go all. I love baseball, and you love baseball, Lee, and you
I
know
love it.
baseball. Yeah, I love baseball. You know baseball. Spin rate and analytical terms and things like that. And I want to give a plug to my buddy John Miller, not the broadcaster, the writer who wrote this book on Earl Weaver, and which everyone, it's on my summer. If I get to the beach 2 weeks from now, I'm taking it with me. But everybody's talked about philosophically how there were analytics in your day, and they were average. You know, like my dad bought the Sporting News because he thought of himself as a mathematician who wanted to figure out angles, and really taught me division and math, and you know how to do an ERA and dividing by nine,
Sure.
and you know all of that
My
through
dad did the
baseball,
same
right?
thing. Yeah.
So we all did, right? I'm asking who we are, right? But to have the math part of this, my dad would love the math part of it. He might not like the strategy and the ball, like all of the weirdness of it, and the manager's not managing. I know Earl wouldn't like that. Bobby, nobody like that. But there are some parts of the science of this that I would think you would be taking seriously if you were there. And part of it is rotation of the ball and things that Earl Weaver couldn't quantify in regard to on base percentage, but he knew it was important. And I knew when I had Strat-O-Matic cards that a walk was as good as a hit.
Right.
But that's old school terminology. In the modern vernacular, they have science and cameras. And I always think of sitting in Tony Gwynn's little office out at Jack Murphy Stadium, that little closet he had with a video camera. You know what I'm
Yeah.
talking about? Like, that was technology then. How would you employ some of this? Not the jibber jabber on TV, but I would think they could bring you something that would tell you about spin rate or about angles that would help you be a better pitching coach.
Right. Well, number one, spin rate. Okay. The greatest pitching coach in the history of baseball was Johnny Sain. Johnny Sain was, he was my guru. What did Johnny Sain have? He had the spinner and he had a ball on a tool and he said, "Come here, Leo," and he would spin him. He was putting aerodynamics, he was a pilot, so he was putting aerodynamics to the spins of a baseball on how they would move. So when I hear that, I go, "Wait, wait, wait! Somebody was way ahead of their time, right before you hear all this." And he told me, he showed me the backspin on a four seam fastball, over the top spin on a two seam fastball. It's the spins on breaking balls, the smaller breaking balls, control breaking balls, take out breaking balls, the spins on the changeup.
I'm thinking like
So,
a guy like Ted Williams would know that and had the vision to see the seams, which is how he hit 400. Same thing probably with Gwynn. I mean, he's superhuman dudes, right?
and Barry Bonds too. That's what Barry Bonds' dad told me, that he could read the spin coming out of a pitcher's hand faster than anybody. But anyway, so now when I'm sitting there watching pitchers spin pitches, what I want to see, I didn't use how fast it was going. What I would say is the faster the ball, the ball spins, the better it breaks, not how hard you throw it. Okay? The other one was if I saw a break, a fastball, and he threw the fat and it cut. And they'd say, "Oh, that's a cutter." I said, "Wait a minute, wait a minute. Did you try to cut it?" "No." "Well, if you didn't try to cut it, do you know when it's going to cut?" "No." "Well, then if you don't know when it's going to cut, that's only going to be a 50-50 pitch. You know, and half the time it's going to cut over the middle and it's gone, you know." So I looked for consistency. You find out what caused the cut or what causes something to move, or what causes something that you want to go straight, you know. But those are the spins that you read. And as soon as you see, for example, if you see Tom Glavine's changeup, right, and it spins the same all the time, all the time. Maddux's two seam fast, the spin, it never deviates, doesn't tilt, doesn't, the spins are the same all the time. So we talked about spin, the consistency of the spin on a particular pitch. I never used the term spin rate because I just thought if the ball, he has a good spin on the ball, it's going to break. And the bottom line is this: you, if they learn how to spin the ball and not throw it so damn hard, then they lower the risk of arm injury. And how do you acquire that? You make the full circle back to the mound and practice it at 60 feet, 6 inches going downhill to a catcher. So that's when you take care of spins. That's when you took care of all this stuff. And Bobby used to look out the, before a baseball game, say, "Where in the hell's all the pitchers? We don't have nobody tagging ball. They're all in the bullpen with me. We're all, and just because so-and-so's day isn't to throw, they can be up there with me, and we're all putting input, you know, and having this conversation on anything from location to movement to change of speeds." We used to say you get a hitter out five ways: stuff, movement, change of speeds, location, and motion. All five play a part. And some of those are going to be different between the individuals as what their strength is. But the location has to be for everybody. That has to be for everybody. And I think, you know, Maddox used to tell me, he says, "Velocity, Leo, is about fourth on my list. It's movement, location, change of speeds, velocity." So, in other words, teaching pitchers how to do that You cannot do that by throwing a damn weighted ball up against a wall. You can't do it by pulling all these bands and doing all this stuff if you don't go out on the mound and practice it. And then most pitchers don't, they don't do that anymore.
Well, we're in football training camp and they don't hit anymore. And so, I mean,
Yeah, that.
like literally, and then you wonder why they can't tackle in week one.
That's
They're not even employing
the,
their craft, like literally. Leo
right.
Mazzoni is here. He tackles baseball better than anybody. Last thing for you, because I mean, I could go into the Orioles and into Tommy John. There's so many lanes I could go into, like trading deadline and all that. Pitch clock. And, Ray Miller was my guy early on. I knew him better than I knew you. And it was, work fast, change speeds, throw
Yeah.
strikes. You know what I mean? Like he had three
Great pitching,
things, you
great
had
pitching
five
coach.
things, right? And
Yeah.
the late great Ray Miller. And but the pitch clock, his first credo was work fast. Like get the ball back. Don't let the pitcher. You got the ball. Get on the hill. Get him in the box. But the clock sort of works against the pitcher, although it can work against human rain delays. Get free strikes for the pitcher if they can't
Right.
get in the box. But how has that? I mean, games move fast in your era, my era, Jim Palmer. They got the ball and they did it because Ray Miller told them to do it. I never saw Maddux out there, cleaning his spikes. He
No.
was like, get in the box. I'm going to kick your ass. Let's go.
We always said upbeat tempo, pick up the tempo, pick up the tempo. That means we're either picking up the tempo in between pitches or we're picking up the tempo from start to finish when we unload a pitch. So that was a constant. And I did hear
So
at one
pitch
time,
clock wouldn't have scared you. I mean, right? No, right?
no, I wasn't no pitch, I didn't. Hell, I used to cheat on pitch counts anyway, when before they put them on the board. But no, somebody said earlier, major, somebody said, well, pitch clock's going to cause pitchers to maybe hurt their arm because they don't have enough recovery time in between pitches. That wanted to make me throw up. That has nothing, the pitch has nothing to do with any type of arm injury. And great pitching coaches like Ray Miller, who is a good friend of mine, upbeat tempo, work fast, da 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 da. That's always been there. Now, I think the pitch clock works for some guys that are a human rain delay, because we're screaming, throw the ball because the morning newspaper is going to be here before you ever get done this game. So you're always pushing upbeat tempos, but there's nothing wrong with the pitch clock. I mean, nothing wrong with that at all. I don't think it has anything to do with anything, to be honest with you, except maybe some pitcher that's slow has to speed his things up, and that should help him, not hurt him.
Leo Mazzoni is always a great resource. I'm gonna let you get back out on the lake down there and catch your fish.
It's too hot. It's 100 degrees.
Well, you're happy to hear talk baseball. Do you have anything on the Orioles and the failure of what's happened here this year and the weight of new ownership and just it really was going well. I was so going so well
Doing
last
great.
May. I said to my wife, and I'm 56 years old, Leo. I've been through all of it, back to like Palmer, Vida, Blue, Cuellar,
Sure.
73, 74 is where I kind of came into the movie after my cousin came here in 66 and won the World Series. I said to my wife, this might be the best team I've ever seen them have. When they had Rutschman, Henderson, Westberg, all these guys are coming up. Cowser was hitting the ball. They had Bradish coming back into the rotation off kind of a Cy Young year. Rodriguez was the up and coming, whether it was going to be a Storm Davis or whether it was going to be a Jim Palmer, who knows,
Right.
but he was going to be something. And then the Corbin Burns thing last year, they had him here all last year, so they had
He
a real one.
was one of my favorite pitchers to watch last year. And when they lost him, I think that took a big chunk out of their starting
You don't
rotation.
replace the Roger Clemens of the modern era, right? I mean, that kind of
Absolutely.
that horse in the front, and
Yes.
they're a mess right now. I mean, it got the manager fired, all of that. Do you have anything on the Orioles for me?
Well, I think you just told the story right there, starting pitching. I mean, if you look at Baltimore, you're naming a chance to have a very good rotation to having you don't know who you have. You really don't know who you have. And I think they're going to finish the season over 500. I think that I like their lineup. I still do. And I like their ball club, but I don't think their pitching's very good at all, to be perfectly honest with you. But I think you could say that to 50% of the major league teams. And but when you don't keep a guy like Burns, who, in other words, you have that guy that you're probably not going to have a lot of losing streaks, and let me tell you this, the thinking behind that for me is this: when we signed Maddux in 93, all right, we had a chance to sign Bonds or Maddux because Ted Turner said we had one big bullet to shoot. They asked me, and I said, who do you think I'm going to pick? I'm a pitching coach, you know. But Bobby Cox had the final say, and it was split in the room. Bobby said, all I can tell you is if we sign Greg Maddux with the rotation that we have in place, we'll never have a losing streak. So when you look at pitching and you look at a guy like Burns and you look at, you think, you know, and then add a starter here or there, and you've got four guys that you can run out there and count on, that's when you're going to win. And that the Orioles with that ball club that they have in place now, if they had that, they'd be winning.
They deserve better pitching, really, at this point. You know, so
Absolutely,
do the
they do.
fans. Leo Mazzoni is here. I always love having you on. I'm sorry I was a bit tardy, Professor.
No, 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 no.
It's always good to see you. What are you doing anything charitably? You're always doing good stuff, man. I know
Well,
you.
yeah, no, I mean, you know, we have a dog shelter that we take care of in Atlanta, Furry Friends Foundation, my wife and I, and we just and we adopt, you know, it's an adoption place.
Sure.
So yeah, we you know, we have we just have an affinity for that. We love our dogs and stuff like that. So, but I, you know, and my sons have all grown and got a grandson in Maryland. My son's a detective in Cumberland. Then I have a son that's working in Ohio in the mines, and I have two granddaughters with him, but he's not in the mines. He's in the front office in Salem, Ohio. And then I have my son Chris is down the road in coaching teenage baseball, and doing well as a full-time job. And he's doing well living in Acworth, Georgia, right outside of Atlanta. And there's another thing we can do a whole new show on.
What's that?
Travel ball. The pitchers, young pitchers are getting their arms ruined. Travel ball because they're being told if they don't hit a certain number on a radar gun, they don't make a club. And that's from 12 years old up to 18. 12 to 18 pitch. And then if you're pitching almost year round, once baseball season's over, a youngster should play another sport. And there's nothing wrong with throwing a baseball year round, except now they're throwing them competitively almost year round. And 12-year-old arms can't take that. And the way pitchers are handled, I've spoke to coaches and everybody about this, about taking care of your kid's arm, you know. And all they talk about is, oh, he hit 82, you know, as he's 14 years old, 13 years old. Who cares? Can he throw a strike? What's great about throwing 82 for ball four when you're a kid? In the big leagues, who cares if you throw 100 miles an hour for ball four, or you're all over the place? That's why their pitch counts are up. They're all over the damn place. And my feeling is this: you should not, the pitcher on this thing of starters and relievers, they should not call them pitchers anymore. You just call everybody starting throwers and relief throwers. Because that's what you see, with the exception of a few guys like a Burns who pitch. But most of them, all throwers. And that's why you have so many arm injuries. But that's being taught from 12 years of age on up.
Industry standard. I mean, you know, I hear it, and it's like all of your wisdom is nonsense. It's crazy. Leo Mazzoni is here. If Rubenstein called me, I'd call you. I just would, because I know you'd love to help fix the Orioles. So
I would
we
love
all would.
only, you know, not only not to be down there in the dugout, but as an advisor, is what a senior advisor or something like that is what I enjoy. I do that a little bit, but not officially.
Well, don't fish so much or move so far out of it that you lose your passion and that you don't share your wisdom. So I appreciate you waking up early on a weekend and sharing some wisdom with me. Get back to your wife. Get out on the lake. It's always good to visit with you. Thank you, Leo. You're a great guest, man.
Anytime. You keep me on anytime. I love talking baseball with you.
The wisdom of Leo Mazzoni, a Marylander by birth, and you know, I guess a South Carolina. And my mother was from Abbeville, South Carolina. You and I've talked about that. I went down to Greenville. I think I hit you and I hit Coates because his kids all go to Clemson. And I'm
Yeah.
like, hey man, send me someplace in Greenville. I loved Greenville. Well, I went to Greenville. I said to my wife, I'm like, hey, this is a nice place, and it's 20 minutes from where my mom grew up. You know, so I know you're not far away from there.
Voted one of the 10th best places to live in the United States now. And Clemson's right down the street.
All right, well, I'm going to meet you in Greenville for a beer and some proper fried green tomatoes with
I'm in.
Pimento. I need
I'm
some
in.
pimento on
But
that.
I want some. You can't get crab cakes like you can in Maryland. I don't care where you go
I
around
know a
here.
little bit about that, so
Yeah, I
I
know
can
you
work
do.
on that. Leo Mazzoni, always a pleasure to have him on. Hey, if you need to find me, I'm doing a Maryland Crab Cake tour beginning in August. It's our 27th anniversary, featuring my 27 favorite things to eat. We're doing about 8 shows all over town, getting great guests like we had last week, and having Dan Rogers and Cal out. We had such good times this past week on the Crab Cake tour. You'll be hearing that along with Luke from training camp. Yes, it's football season. I'm Nestor. We are WNSD, AM 1570. Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking. Baltimore Positive.